Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us for today's second hour. You'll know our next guest's book is more than another collection of war stories when you read the first paragraph of the first chapter. It starts this way. We shot dogs, not by accident. We did it on purpose, and we called it Operation Scooby. I'm a dog person, so I thought about that a lot. Phil Clay's military narrators do a lot of thinking about their lives in a war zone, about those who lost their lives, and about how hard it is to get used to living at home again after a tour in the hell that the battlefields and back streets of Iraq turned out to be for so many of them. Phil Clay was a Marine who served in Iraq, and his book captures the lives of the grunts, the foot soldiers who did the dirty work of war in a country they didn't understand and in which they were in for increasingly murky reasons. Without a draft, Phil Clay notes, only a tiny percentage of the U.S. population was exposed to its horrors. The military was all volunteer, and is all volunteer, which means they deployed again and again while the rest of America barely noticed. Phil Clay's stories can be frightening, confusing, and darkly comic. Through all of this, he writes, the soldiers who served cling to the belief that what they did was important. The weird thing with being a veteran, he writes, at least for me, is that you do feel better than most people. You risked your life for something bigger than yourself. Maybe you didn't understand American foreign policy or why we were at war. Maybe you never will. But it doesn't matter. You held up your hand and said, I'm willing to die for these worthless civilians. Phil Clay joined the Marine Corps when he graduated from Dartmouth and served in Iraq in 2007, where the seeds of this book called Redeployment, very simply, Redeployment, were sown. Redeployment is absolutely gripping and deserves the terrific reviews that it has received. It's available from the Penguin Press. Phil Clay is our guest today on Midday in this second hour of our show. Phil, welcome to WYPR Baltimore. Thanks for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Please start a little bit with your own story, and then we'll get into the stories of the book. I'm curious about, you know, coming out of Dartmouth, what made you decide to join the Marines?
Well, you know, I started the process in 2003. I was still at Dartmouth. I knew we were going to Iraq. I joined for a lot of the reasons that people join. I wanted to serve my country. I knew we were going to Iraq. I knew that whether or not, you know, Iraq was a good idea. How well we did there would be measured in human lives. I wanted to put myself in a position of responsibility, to where hopefully I could, make a change for the better. I was also a boxer and a rugby player. I mean, the physical challenge and the challenge of the Marine Corps in general appealed to me. A lot of the reasons that people join.
What personal lessons did you take away from your service in the Marines? I mean, knowing what you do now, here we are in 2014, would you do it again?
Yes. I have a lot of complicated feelings about what has happened, over the past decade plus, but I am proud of my service. I worked with some great Marines. I would sign up again, but maybe a little wiser, a little less naive.
Let's talk about the book and the stories in the book. Something our listeners would probably be interested in to know right away is how many of the stories are true, how many of your characters are real, are they all composites? How did you go about this?
Well, so it's all fiction, but I certainly did a lot of research in order to write this book. Every story has a different narrator. You got different jobs. You have a chaplain, a mortuary affairs Marine, an artilleryman. And so one of the things with the job that I did when I was in Iraq, I was a public affairs officer. So I spent a lot of time traveling, or a decent amount of time. I visited most of the major bases in Anbar province, got to hang out with a lot of different types of Marines and soldiers and sailors. And when I came back, I was part of a community of veterans. And I interviewed a lot of veterans. I talked to people. I read a lot of books. I read a lot of journalism. And I tried to inform myself as much about the war as I possibly could so that I could write about it and also answer the kinds of questions that were rattling around in my own head after I got back.
So you would say you got most of your material from your experience in Iraq, or things you picked up in conversations generally?
I don't know if I got my material. I got the drive to write the book. The drive to figure out what I needed to figure out through writing. Running sort of the best way that I know how to think about something.
Right. Your first story seems to express the main themes of the books, what happens in combat and what happens when Marines come home, all of it there. So it's also pretty sad. It begins with that quote that I gave at the outset here, "We shot dogs."
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about that story.
Well, you know, you've got a guy who has just come from the Second Battle of Fallujah, very intense warfare, and he's right back home. And, you know, this is, I think most veterans will tell you this, it's very strange coming back to America from a combat zone. I remember my 2 weeks of leave. So I did 13 months in Iraq, and you get 2 weeks of leave, and they'll fly you anywhere. You know, one of my friends in the Marine Corps during his second deployment flew to Switzerland to go base jumping. But I just wanted to go home. I wanted to see my family. So I went to New York, and, you know, I didn't have a particularly tough job in Iraq, but I did, you know, I live near one of the largest trauma centers, level 2 medical facilities in Anbar province at the time, and certainly saw a lot of injured people coming in. And then to go from that sort of place and then be walking down Madison Avenue 2 days later is just so, you just feel this profound sense of disconnect, because it doesn't feel like we're at war. And that disconnect continues, I think, when you get out. And, you know, I went to New York. I have other friends who went and lived in other places. And if you don't want to pay attention to the fact that we're at war, you don't really have to. And yet you know people who are still in, who are still going over again and again and again, and sometimes very bad things are happening to them.
When your narrator, the narrator of this first story, gets home, where his wife is waiting, a couple of buddies get some nasty surprises from their wives. We could talk a little bit about that, and I
sure.
wonder if that's more common than most people think.
Well, yeah, it certainly happens. You know, you have a lot of young guys. You have I mean, sometimes you have guys making unwise decisions before
right.
they deploy,
right.
But
mm-hmm.
also you just have the strain that deployments put on families, and it's a lot to take. It's a lot for, you know, if you got married at 19 and moved to Jacksonville, and then you went off to war and your spouse was left behind, that's a pretty strange and intense environment to be in for both sides.
You know, the story makes reference to dogs there right at the beginning, and I'm sure our listeners might be wondering what that is about. Maybe we ought to talk about why they shot dogs. We're not giving away the whole story by any means.
Right. So they saw dogs eating corpses, and so they shot the dogs in order to stop them from doing that. I know a couple Marines who talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and some guilt about it, of course, especially if you like dogs. And the thing about guilt is, it sort of hangs over all of the stories, I think, in a way. Guilt and remorse. I don't know if you agree with that, but that's something that we picked up. Either there seems
sure.
to be, you know, too much guilt over what they've had to do, or too little. When they actually seem to be, you know, they're talking about killing people or taking some pride in it. And I just wondered from you today, is that something that's on soldiers' minds when they're in combat or just out of it, freshly out of it, or afterward? Is that something you've heard expressed before, this guilt and remorse?
Well, it certainly, you know, I have a friend, Elliot Ackerman, who wrote a piece about a Marine that he knew receiving a Bronze Star. You know, he'd rushed out under enemy fire to try and rescue a friend, and it failed. And, you know, that at the guy's award ceremonies, you know, he said, yeah, I have conflicted emotions about this because this award, which represents, you know, my greatest success as a Marine and receiving a, you know, Medal for Valor, also represents my greatest failure. And I think that in any kind of intense environment like that, particularly in counterinsurgency, which is a really rough, difficult environment that where you have, you know, Marines making these very serious choices constantly in a murky environment where they don't know who's the enemy, who, you know, who's friend, who's foe. And there's just, they're exposed to a lot of violence and a lot of suffering and so, yeah, you come back and you need to think your way through that. It doesn't, you know, I think a lot of veterans say that they would go back, right? I think they, a lot of times they feel like it, the experience has made them stronger in some ways, but it's definitely something very difficult and trying that they have to work through.
Phil Clay is our guest. His book is called Redeployment. We're going to talk some more after a break about some of the stories in the book. I wanted to ask you this before we go to our first break, Phil.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say personally, and what have you heard others say about this country in a time of war with an all-volunteer military? And I realize, you know, you went to Dartmouth, you volunteered. Everyone you met volunteered. There's no draft in the United States for these two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. But I just wonder about that disconnect, you know, when you come home and it doesn't seem like the country has been at war. Is it war? There's much consciousness about it. People certainly know where you were. They were aware of it at one time, but then interest kind of faded. I just wonder what goes through your mind when you think about those or hear people reference it or ask you a question about it, take mild interest, condescend to ask a question about what you did over there. All of that. I really wanted to hear from you on this.
I think it's important for all of us to take ownership of these wars, right? If you're an American citizen, these are your wars. You know, and I think that's part of the thing that disturbs people when they come back and there's such a lack of interest because, you know, we as citizens are the ones who hold our elected leaders accountable, or we should be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if there's not interest, if there's not pressure on our politicians to pursue military policy well, then we're not going to have good military policy. It's much easier to kind of have war on autopilot if the American people aren't paying attention. That's not good for, you know, the Marines and soldiers who are fighting. You want a critically engaged populace.
Some people argue, and it's a tempting idea to support, that if you had mandatory service for everybody, either military or public service of some kind, that the citizenry would be more engaged, especially if some knew that they faced possible military service. You know, if not a draft, full-scale draft.
Of course. I mean, you certainly would. It'd be a very different world if we did that. I seriously doubt that there is that there's the political will to go back to a draft. I think that, you know, we like our volunteer military.
Well, politicians especially, Phil, don't they?
Exactly. It's certainly an issue. It's one of the reasons that I wrote the book was, you know, to reach out and engage with people about what these wars meant.
So the veterans come home and they, what's their view of this war in terms of Iraq I'm talking about, in terms of what happened there, what they did for their country? Can they characterize what the mission was and what was accomplished?
Depends on who you're talking to. Depends on, you know, you'll have different views within the same platoon, but also if you have different guys in different units at different times. I knew... you know, there's one unit who's doing security missions around a base, and they were there through 2006, through a lot of really severe violence. And, you know, when they left, they left with just the blackest view. A lot of those guys left with just the blackest view of what had happened. And then the unit that replaced them, of course, was there through the search. So they saw, you know, violence radically declining in Anbar province while they were there. And, you know, those guys tended to feel much more positively about the war effort and what we were doing, and that we were having a real sort of solid impact in terms of security gains for the country. And I certainly know that a lot of veterans, I mean, you saw with the news today in northern Iraq and you know, earlier, Fallujah and Ramadi had the same thing taken to them, insurgents taking over those cities. That was a real blow for a lot of the people who serve there, and very hard to deal with and think about what that means in relationship to their service and what, you know, what we did in terms of Iraq. And I think people are coming up with their own individual answers. I don't think there's one veteran answer.
Phil Clay is our guest. His book is called Redeployment. It's published by the Penguin Press. Phil Clay, a Marine veteran and author of this collection of stories from the Iraq War. A short break here. We'll continue our conversation with Phil after this. These messages from WYPR. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Marine veteran Philip Clay, talking about his collection of tales from the Iraq War called Redeployment. This is powerful reading and very accessible, well worth your time. So it's recommended by our staff here at Midday. Phil, before we go back to the book and talk some more about this, some of the stories in there, I wanted to ask you about stories in the news in recent weeks, recent days. One is has to do with the Veterans Administration, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and this internal audit showing that the agency said that more than 57,000 new patients have waited at least 90 days for their first appointments for medical treatment or to see a doctor. And in Maryland, we've had a report showing that Maryland is right in there with facilities of the VA that have had long waiting lists for treatment. First of all, that story, I just wonder what your reaction has been to that and what you've been hearing about it.
I mean, you know, it's pretty terrible. I think there's a journalist, Jacob Siegel, who's an Iraq and Afghanistan veteran, who's been doing some great reporting on that for the Daily Beast. You know, most of the people at the VA are fantastic that I've encountered. I think that when we went into these wars, we didn't go in expecting the costs to be what they were. You know, they were sold as sort of wars that would be much less costly. And I think it's tremendously important that we care for the people who went over who are having difficulties. And yeah, and I think that the biggest thing is that, you know, more resources for the VA. It's very easy to, you know, point fingers. But at the end of the day, you know.
Well, what do you take away from it? You take away from it possibly that we talk a good game about supporting our troops. That's what you hear a lot. I support our troops. I support our veterans. You hear it from politicians. And then you look at this and you say, in practice, it's not happening. It's awful. There's some, ingrained culture in the Department of Veterans Affairs? Or is it reflective of how we actually operate as a country, saying one thing and doing another?
I think it's reflective of the the increased caseload. I mean it's not something I'm you know an expert about, but I think that you know certainly you know it would be nice if we could pin all the problems on one person, right? When in fact, you know, when these sorts of things happen, there are always institutional incentives for it to happen. And,
you know, Phil, it seems to me like the war and how veterans are treated, all of that is flowing over there to the side of the rest of American society, that it's not really integrated, that it's this separate stream of episodes and developments and happenings that the most people in the mainstream aren't involved in. A lot of people don't even know a veteran.
It depends on where you live.
Yeah.
And I think that, right, and certainly in the age of the all-volunteer military, it's much easier to hang all of our feelings about the wars on veterans, to feel disconnected or that it's not really your issue or, hey, at the end of the day, they signed up, so this
is
what
happened. At the end of the day, they signed up, they volunteered. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about, related to the Department of Veterans Affairs, all these stories about the suicide rate in the Army in particular, PTSD and the other stress on people returning from Iraq and now Afghanistan. What do you say about it? Do you think this is worse than in earlier wars, or has it just been more publicized, or is it different?
You have these issues in other wars. The VA estimates, I think it's somewhere between 11% and 20% of veterans with some form of PTSD. Mm-hmm. They also estimate, you have PTSD in the general population. I think about 8% of people are expected or to develop PTSD at some point in their lives. And that ranges from, more severe PTSD to milder cases. I think Vietnam veterans have higher rates. I think it was something around 30% is what the VA currently has on its website. So you have these issues in other conflicts. I mean, every conflict has had, these kind of casualties. I mean, Herodotus talks about somebody seeing a Greek soldier seeing his buddy killed in front of him and going blind, even though he was not actually struck.
Mm-hmm.
This is something I think for every war and for every war, it's important to try and support them and move forward in our ability to care for those with the condition.
There's one other thing from the news, another story from the news that I just wanted to get your thoughts on, and that is this story about Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. The President Obama's decision to trade 5 Taliban fighters from Guantanamo, who are being held at Guantanamo, for Sergeant Bergdahl, who's been a prisoner for, 5 years?
Right.
So I wonder what your thoughts are on all of this. It's been highly politicized. It's become very controversial. And you were a Marine, and Marines have an old saying that they don't leave men behind. That's generally been the posture of the government, of the administration, with regard to this captured soldier. So anyway, your thoughts about this, Phil Clay?
I mean, it's it's strange because it has become so politicized and a kind of vehicle for a particular type of political outrage. People have tried and convicted Bo Bergdahl in their own minds already. I certainly understand the frustration and anger that you hear from members of his unit. I know somebody from Bergdahl's unit, and so I certainly understand that perspective. But I should note that as I think it was Nathan Bradley. Who talked about, Bergdahl having left his post in the Daily Beast. He was glad that they had got Bergdahl home, right? We don't go, we're not going to bring you home if, we might then later want to bring you up on charges for something. I think that I'm glad that he's home. And, I'm sure that at least at the very most, I hope that they'll look into the issue. But, however you feel about the man, I wouldn't wish what he went through on anyone. And I wouldn't wish what his family went through on anyone. And particularly, the attacks against the family are, I think, unfortunate, to say the least.
Yeah. I'll go further and say pretty offensive.
And it's vile.
It's vile. Okay.
It's utterly vile.
Say what you want, Phil. I don't even put words in your mouth, but that's how I feel about it. That's been my reaction to it. Because we don't know. You know. We don't know the whole story. There are feelings, and then there are facts, right? We don't have all the facts.
And I think that it's good that you know, that there will be pressure to search through the facts. As I said, I certainly understand the feelings of the members of his unit, but that's different from the sort of, you know, political circus that has emerged and I think complicates the issue.
Yeah. The New York Times reporting on Sunday that Sergeant Bergdahl told the medical officials where he's being treated in Germany that his captors locked him in a metal cage in total darkness for weeks at a time as punishment for trying to escape. Furthermore, according here from the Times, and while military doctors say he now is physically able to travel, he is not yet emotionally ready for the pressures of reuniting with his family. And I don't know if you saw this report in Sunday's paper, Phil, but it went on to note that they've kept media completely away from him, news reports completely away from Sergeant Bergdahl, at least until the time of this story was written, saying that he's oblivious to this criticism from members of Congress about the prisoner swap. Does the prisoner swap offend you as a way of getting the release of this Army sergeant?
Personally, no. But I'm not fully aware of all the details of it. But it doesn't. I think that, you know, if I were captured, if somebody I served with were captured, I would hope that they would make a deal
to get you home.
Right.
Yes. Phil Clay is our guest, a Marine veteran of Iraq. His book of stories called Redeployment, simply Redeployment. The publisher is the Penguin Press, and we'll go back and talk some more about some of the stories in your book in just a moment. I wanted to take a phone call here, Phil, if that's okay, from our listeners here in the Baltimore area.
Sure.
Saeed in Baltimore wanted to make a comment about war and combat. Saeed, thank you for calling Midday.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your service. I did not actually service in the United States Armed Forces. I am originally from Iran, and I had to actually serve as a draftee in Iran Army. And from my experience, and which is pretty much the same with a lot of veterans that I talk to, when you go to combat, that is when your life changes. That is when everything finds different color and shape. And I think because you find yourself in a position that you can feel the loss, but that loss is loss of yourself, loss of your life or the ones that you belong to.
When you say loss of yourself, you mean the person you were before combat? Is that what you mean, Saeed?
It would be all of the above.
Yeah. Phil,
it would be actually a person that you've been before, and also it would be you picture yourself in that position, in that, looking at yourself as a dead body on the ground, as a corpse.
Well, let me talk to Phil about that a little bit. Wonder what your thoughts are about that. And, you know, personality change, and actually what Saeed said there, sort of envisioning yourself being killed in combat.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's like the old, imagine that you're already dead, and then you can function under high stress.
Yeah.
It's something that some soldiers talk about. It's... For some Marines, some soldiers, absolutely. You know, it can be a defining moment. There are people who miss it. In that first story that I wrote, the guy comes back and then realizes that even though he hated every moment of his deployment, he feels this urge to go back. There's this intensity to a place where there are life and death decisions. So, you know, everything is sort of infused with meaning and purpose. You're part of a collective, you know, you're part of a group that you know very well, that you are trusting with your life. They're trusting you with their lives. And, you know, you're with them 24/7, depending on each other in a very high-stakes environment. And then you come back to a civilian world that seems colorless in comparison. Mm. There are a lot of things about war that can change people. And some things about sort of, you know, that collective purpose, that sense of community, some things that are very positive that people miss when they're back home. And then there's also the you know, the violence and the just the intense difficulty of the experience that also can change people.
Phil, take a little break here and come back and talk some more. Phil Clay is our guest. His book is simply called Redeployment, a collection of stories from the Iraq War. He's a Marine veteran of Iraq. This is Midday on WYPR. We'll be right back. And this is Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Phil Clay, K-L-A-Y, Marine veteran, author of this new collection of tales from the Iraq War called Redeployment. And Phil, I was talking about how guilt and remorse looms over these stories quite a bit. There's one story here. I thought this was, they're all interesting. This one is a Marine who takes credit for a kill that belonged to another Marine. Let's see if I have it right. Because the Marine who actually shot, in this case it was an insurgent, just felt so guilty about having killed a teenager. Even though the teenager was shooting at them, with an AK-47. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that and the effect it had on the Marine who knew he actually had nothing to feel guilty about.
Well, you know, the shooter is, he's the first guy in the unit to have killed anyone. And, you know, there's it's a unit of young guys. They talk about war and killing, you know, with this sort of excitement. Right. And then when he actually shoots a kid, it doesn't feel good. It's not necessarily that he doesn't wish he hadn't, you know, that he wishes he hadn't done it because, you know, the circumstances are such that he's being shot at. And yet it is a very serious thing. And so he doesn't want the other people asking him what was it like, and this is something that a lot of veterans talk about. You know, you get back, what's the question that everybody wants to ask, or that you get asked a million times, is, did you kill anybody? And whether you did or didn't, it's not a great question to receive. And this, you know, this Marine wants to avoid that kind of uncomfortable, voyeuristic, excited response to him killing someone because he doesn't feel about it that way now that he's actually done it.
You know, all my years as a reporter, and I've interviewed veterans from World War I to Iraq and Afghanistan, I never asked that question, I guess out of respect or something. And the one time it was volunteered, and volunteered with some relish by a World War II veteran, mm-hmm. I was suspicious of whether it was true, because all the other, you know, because all the other veterans I had interviewed over the years had never talked about killing another man on their own, unsolicited, and I had never asked. That doesn't mean they didn't. I didn't go one way or the other on that. But in the one instance where I remember a veteran of World War II speaking with great relish about the number of enemy he had killed, I was suspicious of whether it was true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's take a phone call from Towson. Jim, another one of listeners. Oh, you know, Jim was calling in to say, you know, in the Bergdahl matter, to give him some mercy, considering what he's been through and all the judgments that are being made from thousands of miles away about whether the Sergeant Bergdahl, who, by the way, he doesn't like to be called Sergeant Bergdahl, apparently, because he was promoted during his captivity. He was a private. you know, judgments are being made about what he did and didn't do, I guess because of the members of his unit, because of what they have said about him, wondering whether he deserted or wandered off,
right.
and raising questions about in that regard. So, again, we don't know everything, and I'm just a little concerned about the rush to judgment here, and I do wonder about all these politicians who are howling about it. They just be quiet for a little while until we get some more information. I want to go back to your book, Phil, the narrator in your story. Very interesting narrator. Never killed anyone himself. But can you tell us a little bit about him? I think this is listeners will find this intriguing because his combat story is so interesting. It's not the kind of stuff we normally read about.
The narrator of After Action Report?
Yeah, that one in particular,
so,
yeah.
He's a military policeman, and military police units did convoy security in Iraq, and that's what they're doing. And he sits in the gunner seat. And after he takes credit for his friend's kill, and people start asking him about it, he starts trying to figure out what his friend is going through because the friend doesn't say anything, and he's worried about him. And he ends up going to the staff sergeant and having these kind of long conversations with the staff sergeant or with the chaplain about the ethics of war and the violence in Iraq and what's going on and how it ought feel. And he kind of gets these sort of different viewpoints as he's trying to piece together what's going on with his friend. But at the same time, they're always out on the roads, and the big threat in the roads is not, the biggest threat is not small arms fire, it's IEDs. So they're just going down, waiting for the next IED to strike.
Phil, one of the guilt trips in your book, I mentioned these stories of guilt in here, is a former Army psychological warfare officer, I think, during the Battle of Fallujah.
Psychological operations specialist.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. So he's one of the few non-Marines who narrates a story, I believe, and he musters out, he takes the GI Bill benefit to go to Amherst College in Massachusetts, which
right.
is not, it's a little smaller version of Dartmouth, one state away, right? So, I was just wondering if anything of you was in that story, which deals in part with what people expect, when they meet an Iraq or Afghan war veteran.
Well, I wasn't a veteran when I was at Dartmouth.
No, right.
He's a complicated character because he is proud of his service in a certain way. He's, when you had quoted him earlier talking about, actually feeling pride about the fact that he had signed up. But he also feels conflicted about some of the things that he was a part of and that he went through, and he has a kind of complicated relationship with his father, and he ends up offending a Muslim student. And then, has this sort of long conversation with her where he tries to explain himself and also explain what he's been through. And the whole time he's also highly conscious of the way that his status as a veteran plays. He's aware of, he gets in some sort of academic trouble and he manipulates his status as a veteran to help, ease his way out of the issue that he's gotten himself into. He's a very, he's a very smart, self-aware character.
Mm-hmm. What was it like for you mustering out of leaving the Marine Corps once you got home? I mean, what is it like being a former Marine? Although I guess you're always a Marine, but I mean, not actually be in the Marine Corps anymore.
Well, it takes time for you to figure out what you are because you're part of this intense community. It was your whole life. It consumed a lot of your life. And then I'm in New York. I went to a creative writing program which is a bit of a culture shock. You're not supposed to express your opinions in creative writing programs the way that you express them in, among Marines. You're supposed to be a little more gentle. I felt, and I think a lot of people out of the military feel this, is sort of a little bit of loss and also this weird kind of disconnect because the wars are still going on. I'm a veteran, and yet the wars are still going on, and I'm not going to them. And yet people that I know are going, and sometimes, you know, bad things are happening to them. And at the same time, I'm trying to build a life for myself that is not just about the military, not just about being a veteran. I found, you know, great I had a great community of friends in New York, had a great family, and also I found a community of veteran writers that was really important to me. And so it's a kind of slow process of easing out of the military and finding out who you are.
And I assume the reason for the book is to work out some of these things that you had in your mind when you got back from Iraq, experiences that stayed on your mind and that were troubling, the conversations that you'd had with others. So I assume that's part of the reason for doing this writing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you find it weird and difficult just to be around civilians for a while? I noticed you went to the college you referred to as Hunter College, right, in New York.
Yes, Hunter. Yeah.
What was
excellent MFA program.
Yeah. I mean, did you just find it hard to be around civilians and talk about things that seemed trivial compared to what you'd been through?
It was actually great because, you know, non-military stuff is not trivial, right? It just doesn't have the kind of intensity, right? And so, you know, I was around particularly at Hunter, a lot of great writers, with Bill Chang and who wrote Southern Cross the Dog and was one of my classmates. And another classmate, Scott Cheshire, has a book called High as the Horse's Bridles. It's coming out, I think, this month or next month, which is just a beautiful book. And Lauren Holmes, another just like phenomenal writers who actually really added to my own understanding of what I'd been through. So I had veteran writers that I met through the NYU Veteran Writing Program, and they were great for calling me out on particular types of BS that civilian readers wouldn't necessarily pick up on. But the civilian readers were critiquing my stories and getting me involved in conversations that were different and enriching and enlarging in other areas. So I was very lucky to have both of those.
I wanted to go back with you a little bit over what you think about Iraq in terms of what it meant to this country. Looking back on it all now, your own service and those of thousands of others, what do you say about it? If anybody even asks you during conversations with friends now in civilian life, if it comes up, what do you say about it? When you hear someone say, well, it was a waste, it was a big mistake, it was based on a lie by the Bush administration, by Bush himself. When you hear those things, what do you say?
Well, it went on for years. There's no question. I mean, you look at what's happening in Iraq today, that the end result has been just a tremendous amount of violence, a tremendous amount of suffering, mostly borne by the Iraqi people. And there's a lot to say about that. There's a good book by an Iraqi writer, Hassan Blossium, called The Corpse Exhibition, which is worth reading. But I think the desire to pin everything on Bush is an easy way out. We were in Iraq for a long time, and you know, there were a lot of policy decisions that were made. And, you know, there could have been weapons of mass destruction all over Iraq, but we still would have needed a good plan, which we didn't have. We still would have needed, you know, to hold our elected leaders accountable. to make sure that we were executing sensible policy and that, you know, we weren't continuing with bad policy or with, you know, bad leaders. I think, you know, the fact that Donald Rumsfeld was the Secretary of Defense as long as he was is sort of mind-boggling, given you know, what a failure he was. And that decision, you know, that alone had very severe consequences. I think that we'd like to wrap a neat bow around Iraq and, you know, blame the bad things that happened on a few people and then feel good about ourselves. And I don't think that we get to do that. I think that there's a lot more. I think there are more questions to be asked.
Questions to be asked among the thinking people, if people are even thinking about it anymore. I mean, what do you find to be the prevailing American attitude about that experience of 10 years, 2003 to 2013, now 2014, Iraq and Afghanistan? People hardly even talk about it, Phil.
Well, you know, I've gotten a lot of interesting responses to my book from veterans and civilians alike. And there are more veterans who are starting to write books. Elliot Ackerman, who I mentioned earlier, is a book coming out called Green on Blue, and Gavin Kovite, who is in Fire and Forget with me. It's an anthology of veterans fiction. It's a book that he co-wrote with another friend of mine, Chris Robinson, who's not a veteran, called The War of the Encyclopedists. It's coming out next year, which will have, you know, people from both sides of the civilian-military divide. And I think, a buddy of mine, Matt Gallagher, wrote a great book. There's I think you're going to see more and more veteran voices, people who want us to really examine this. I think that our image of Iraq is being shaped. We're starting to try and come to terms with what we did, and I think that reckoning is really important. And there are a lot of different aspects of it, and I don't think that we can expect it to be done anytime soon. But I think that you're going to see more and more discussion.
What are you doing now, Phil? What's next?
I'm writing an article for Men's Journal about wingsuit base jumping.
About what?
Wingsuit base jumping. One of the Marines that I served with in Iraq.
Oh, yeah, you said he went off and did some base jumping.
Yeah, so I'll write an article about that. A little bit different.
What? Okay. Well, Phil, thanks very much. Thanks for this book.
All right. Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a lighter subject. Yep. Thank you very much for having me.
It's powerful stuff. The book is called Redeployment. Our guest has been Phil Clay. Watch for his byline. Phil Clay, K-L-A-Y. The book is published by the Penguin Press. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning into our midday for today. Dan Rodericks saying, have a great afternoon. We'll see you again in about 22 hours.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman in High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Rodrick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.